So in this episode of the series titled simply Returns, we're going to be looking at that pain point. 89% of consumers say that ease of returns is a top priority when purchasing online and that returns process should be easy and convenient. And this episode is therefore going to explore how retailers are streamlining their returns process for customers, making sure they get their money back swiftly and products are back on sale as quickly as possible. I'm Katie Searles, editor of DeliveryX, and I'm joined as always by my co-host Ian Jindal, Editor-in-Chief of Internet Retailing. Do you want to give us a little blurb about yourself, Ian?
Well, again, I think you just said it. So I run Internet Retailing and I think a lot about returns.
Excellent. And I'm joined by Narvar's Chris Hoskins. And Chris, a little blurb from you.
Yeah, hi. I look after marketing in the European region for Narvar. We have a post-purchase platform that helps retailers get a handle on things like returns, amongst many other things.
Joining us remotely today as well is Ricky Wilson, who we'll hear from now.
I'm Ricky Wilson. I'm the VP of Global E-commerce and Digital Operations at Pandora Jewelers. We're the world's largest jewellery brand. We're headquartered in Copenhagen, where some of my team are. We operate in over 100 countries, through near enough 7,000 points of sale, I guess, and over 2,500 stores that we own and operate. We've got transactional websites in about a fifth of those markets, and our online sales are in the region of about 0.7 billion euros, something like that, which is just over about a quarter of the company revenue.
That is a lot of revenue.
It's not bad, is it?
I mean, every time I hear, you know, Ricky or David talking about their turnover, I just keep thinking, that is a lot of bracelets and bits and bobs in there.
It's every occasion. Yeah. You're sorted for every birthday going
nearly
forward.
3 billion euro turnover.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. Who else have we got?
We've also got Stephen Irwin, who is the director of Wolverine Worldwide, and I'll let him tell us a little bit about himself.
Hi, my name's Stephen Irwin. I've been in the e-com industry now for a little over 14 years, working from startup to scale up, and currently working as e-com director for EMEA in Wolverine Worldwide. Wolverine is a portfolio business with a house of more than 12 brands, actually. The main brands that I focus on kind of day-to-day within the EMEA region is Merrell, which is a primarily outdoor-based business looking after kind of hiking, athletic hike, etc. Then we have Saucony, which is a performance running brand and also has a kind of sister brand within that stable as Saucony Originals, which is a lifestyle and fashion business. Then we have brands from Caterpillar to Hush Puppies within the stable as well. And most recently, we acquired Sweaty Betty. So that was back in 2021. Wolverine has been primarily a wholesale business for quite some time. However, it has invested more and more in the direct-to-consumer space over the last few years. And actually, even the acquisition of Sweaty Betty was to kind of further embed into that space, because the acquisition meant also bringing in an apparel business into primarily a footwear-driven business, and a female consumer-led business, and also a direct-to-consumer-based business as well. So the acquisition was somewhat strategic. Our global revenues in 2021 were kind of 2.4 billion with a growth of 35%. Our direct-to-consumer growth in 2021 overall was 47%. So we're really focusing on that space and have invested infrastructure into the business to kind of support that. I just joined Wolverine late in that journey, or early, depending on what way you look at it. But I've joined Wolverine around 4 months ago. So now I really got my feet under the table and now looking at how I can add value to the business direction and really take the business to the next stage on the D2C journey. And that's a different strategy across each of the brands. Of course, some of them are a little bit further along than others, and we're kind of tailoring that approach whilst also benefiting from our economies of scale.
That's a lot of leggings.
There's a lot of leggings.
And walking boots and running shoes.
And a lot of things to come back, a lot of things that are difficult to know if you want. I've got a mixed view on returns. I think the process has to be easy, seamless, optimized, blah, blah, blah. But I also think it's never going to be nothing. So if you want people to try things at home, there are things that I would call good returns. So, you know, if you're looking for a pair of shoes and you pick a pair of shoes in a 43, 44, 45, same product, then you can pretty much tell the two of those are coming back. Because I like brand shoes, but I cannot simultaneously be three sizes. So I may as well send the customer a return thing saying, once you tried them on, here's a little, you know, sanitary wipe, stick them in the box, send two back to me. Was I think when you've got maybe 15 different dresses all being next day delivered for a Friday, then you know that someone's basically doing a trunk, you know, fashion show try on, and you've got no idea if they're all staying or all coming back. So I think you need to build in your customer behavior model. And those are both very different to damaged in transit, incorrect picks, which are obviously things you want to totally eliminate. But I think the first category, the try on, is kind of a function of people trying, experiencing, being sure at home rather than in your store.
Absolutely spot on. I couldn't agree more. If you take one of Stephen's brands, so Saucony, you know, that's a product for someone that's pretty serious about running, I think. It's highly likely that they're probably going to try that on, you know, in a physical place, in a physical store. Someone that takes running that seriously is going to want to kind of feel that product. But as you say, other products, people will, we call it bracketing, but they'll buy...
Oh, nice phrase.
They'll buy free items, there'll be different sizes or different colours. And as you say, the merchant is fully expecting to get some of those back. Mm. So I think the challenge that most of the brands have with returns at the moment is we basically just have kind of a single policy for everyone, no matter what they've bought or where they've bought it from. And it's either free or they get charged for it. Mm. And so, you know, we're getting to a point where there's going to be a reckoning to do what you said, to weed out people that are kind of bending the return policy rules, someone that is wardrobing, you know, taking photos of themselves in these new outfits, putting them on social, and then sending it all
back
right the way through to kind of, you know, just abusing a policy, i.e., I don't know, making a claim that something wasn't delivered and getting a refund directly from the bank. Like, retailers are going to have to get smart about how they handle those things.
And I think there is a recognition. I mean, many years ago, I worked in a mail order business becoming a digital retailer, and we had decades of experience. For example, you know, October dress purchases returned in November with cigarette burns after the company party. You know, if I told you the plastic Christmas trees returned in January, of course you're going to laugh. It's an actual fact. You know, boxes of branded shoes, they returned. You think nothing of it until the next customer says you're selling fakes because your customer had bought them, returned a fake in the box, kept the real ones. You know, customers do that. But I think statistically, these are what I would call margin calls. Mm-hmm. So if you say that you can increase your sales by 6%, and that 1.5% of that is fraud, well, it's a cost of sale. So I tend not to get too ethically annoyed by things because it's always trying to get this balance. And I do remember doing some work with a luxury brand some years ago, and I was talking to the CFO, and he had a hit list of the worst returners. And we were going to go to the board and say, these people should be banished from our stores because look how much they're returning. And these are kind of things where when you return it, you send someone on a plane to pick it up, fold it, and bring it back. So proper expensive stuff. But when you looked at the people who are doing the returning, they were the top customers. So cool. Yes, they were returning tens of thousands of pounds worth of stuff, but they were spending hundreds of thousands. So I think developing these more joined up models of what's driving not just order level profitability, but customer profitability, product line profitability over maybe a rolling year. These are the kind of metrics we need to move to while at the same time managing order level efficiency.
Because another interesting statistic is 12% of UK shoppers wouldn't shop with a retailer again if the returns policy was bad, if they had a bad experience. So you're talking about losing your high-end customers there, your top spenders, because they've had a bad experience, isn't sort of profitable to lose 12%.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we want to weed out the people that are wardrobing, bracketing, but there is shoppers that are going to return things.
Well, it's interesting. So bracketing is a good thing. So that's one of those things, as Ian said, if I want to buy a T-shirt and I buy, you know, free versions of it, fully intending to send two back, that behaviour is actually a really good behaviour. It's a really healthy behaviour. What's not healthy for the retailer is like a serial returner or a fraudulent returner or a wardrober, you know, someone who's basically, you know, just trying these things on or just looking at them and sending them back. We have to do a better job of looking at the individual consumer data. So what is the consumer typically doing? And can we drive a return in a particular way because of that consumer? So I could be a serial returner, you know, force me to return it to store so that the retailer's claiming some of that margin back. If I'm fraudulently doing things like abusing that policy, then perform some other level of friction. So make people take a photo of things, whatever that friction is, to lower the amount of return is definitely in the interests of the retailers and merchants. But it's super hard in a world where quite often people are writing the reason for a return on a piece of paper. Like like I'm not sure that's scalable.
But also, if you say what's the reason for the return, and the reason is I was wrong, I regret it, I was stupid, no one's going to pick any of those. They're going to say, oh, it's not what you said. Or,
yes.
You know, so again, you can't always accept that. Now, Chris, you help me with one thing, though. We have lots of data systems and platforms that obsess about behaviour, journey mapping, conversion rates, everything we can do to catapult stuff out of our warehouses towards the customer's home. How do we then make sure we're getting this return data in as sophisticated a way and putting it together? I mean, do you have examples of people who are really getting this 360-degree considered stuff, or are we still talking about the catapult system and the regret and bitterness system, but they don't really talk to each other?
I think I understand the question.
I'm talking about how do you put the data together. I'm not seeing that happening. People talk about it, but I don't see this sophisticated single view of the customer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that single view of a customer is definitely a journey, and you know, like it's a destination that you're probably never going to get to. But in terms of like returns, most returns today are managed by a piece of paper in the box where a declaration is made as to the reason. And I think I use the word data. It's not really data. It's a piece of paper. I cannot believe for a single minute that is used to make decisions within a business. So the big move is towards paperless returns and kind of online portals. And at that point, you are capturing data that can drive the decisioning in the right way. For instance, sizing is probably the biggest reason for returns. And most of that is linked to how something was manufactured and where something was manufactured. So that data is being used by merchants to inform the actual manufacturing process. Mm. And unless that's captured digitally, like you just can't use it. I think the other piece is having a map of your customers and having a history of, you know, what your customer is doing and why they are doing it, and having that inform the individual return policy for that person is the direction of travel. So as opposed to having a single policy for every product that you sell, for every customer that buys from you, like that level of sophistication compared to the personalization on the front end, like when, as you say, when you're trying to sell something, the level of maturity for returns personalization is changing dramatically. So, you know, we've seen Next, we've seen Boohoo, we've seen Zara, Uniqlo talking about charging for returns, and everyone's like, oh, you know, this cannot possibly be, you know, returns should be free. Yeah, actually, Boohoo is going to do free returns for its most loyal customers who are a Premier customer, as an example. So it's not quite as cut and dry as the media portray it to be. But I think you can go a step further. I think people that historically are showing a bracketing behaviour or are a member of some kind of loyalty scheme or where you have some data to effectively project a particular return journey of some kind, I think that's the future for returns, deeply personalised rather than just a one-size-fits-all policy.
Mm. And by going to a paperless return, does that also streamline it for the customer? It benefits the retailer, but is it also making it easier for the customer to do it?
Well, I have a printer at home, but I can tell you that it's probably not plugged in and I almost certainly don't have paper for it. So like in a survey of one, it definitely makes my life easier.
Well, I mean, I had a delivery yesterday of coffee. There were a few missing tins of coffee and they were bashed a bit. So what did I do? I just went straight onto the app, talked to a robot, put me in front of a human who said, "That's terrible. Do you want your money back or replacement?" Said, "I'd like my coffee, please." So send them. Said, "Fine, all done." So that's about as paperless as you get. Fantastic service there and then. So I think we're having some retailers who are just setting such a high standard that it becomes the norm. And that literally then trickles down where you don't get any points at all for being as good as Amazon, but you get lots of negative points for not being as perfect as them all the time. So I think that's the reality of the competitive requirement to make returns seamless.
And making returns and exchanges run as smoothly as possible is a priority for one of our guests, Wolverine, as we'll hear from Stephen.
Overall for us, I'd say we're in line with kind of industry norm in the footwear industry. So on the basis of return for us, it's not a major issue, but of course the better we manage that, the better we manage our inventory and the better we manage obviously our net sales, because obviously whatever we sell gross, whatever comes back from the consumers then also takes us down to our net position. We're constantly trying to evolve that because Not so much because our return volume is an issue, but because we want to understand what the issue is for the consumer.
Mm. I think that really very much speaks to what you were saying, Chris, which is a more intelligent approach rather than just an operational approach, you know, understanding the customer.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know, what do you guys think about forms in boxes that you complete? Have you ever completed one honestly?
I was born honest, Chris, but, I think sometimes you just aren't able to because you're fitting into an operational box for them. And when I did some research on this some years ago, you'd see the customer looking down, reading them all and trying to work out, if I say this, will they charge me? Will I get my money back if? And so I think a lot depends on the trust context and the power balance. So if you think, I am a powerful consumer, they're lucky to have my custom, you'll do what you like. Whereas you think, oh my God, they're a luxury brand, I'm lucky to be their customer, there are only six of them left in the world, then you will bend over backwards and you'll write the form out with your left foot, you know, whatever it takes. So I think there are some modalities around these forms. And, you know, one example, you mentioned Patagonia in one of our discussions. There they say very clearly, we have sent this from Europe. We need to know the reason so that we can give you your money back, but get it through customs. So there I'm expecting it to be a French Sûreté style, you know, triple signed off thing, which sometimes it is. So again, I think there is a context, but, you know, jokes apart, I don't want to fill out forms. I just want to get my money back instantly.
Yeah. We've as a company, Narva, I've done a whole ton of research in this area. It's really interesting. I was kind of giggling when you were talking about they're a big brand and, you know, I'm just going to return it. there's a very British kind of philosophy, interestingly, in the research. Brits are way more vengeful when it comes to honestly, when it comes to returns. This is borne out in some research that we did with US consumers and UK consumers. Typically, the behavior in the US, there's way more like return policy abuse in North America than there is in Britain. But when we do it, it's because we feel like we've a disservice has occurred between this big brand who can handle this little bit of deceit, stroke, friendly fraud.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. I think you know, ultimately, consumers, you know, at this point, they want convenience. So whether it's a QR code, paperless, boxless, you know, return to store, return to a convenience store, leave it on the doorstep, like depending on the brand, depending on the story, like most of the time you need to offer as many choices as possible just to kind of remove that friction from the process.
Because returning to a bricks and mortar store is on the increase. It's a benefit for the retailers because if you're going in, you might have a cheeky browse. It also, some retailers such as Reiss are introducing immediate refunds if you bring it back to store. The money's straight back in your account. And let's face it, at the end of the month, some people need that. And we're seeing more and more retailers wanting that to happen because you mentioned earlier, it sort of saves on the logistics side of the business. There's money to be saved there. And actually, Pandora is a retailer that's also offering this. So let's hear from Ricky Wilson.
Coming from a clothing background, I don't really see returns as a big deal for us, right? So our return rates are pretty low. They're in the region of like 6 or 7%, something like that. And when you're used to selling clothing where a third of it might come back, it's, you know, it's fundamentally different. And as a result, we probably haven't prioritised that quite enough. Our returns are free, but we don't have a returns portal, for example, or we don't have a paperless solution yet. We are in the process of rolling out by online return to store, even though we had an offline way of doing that, shall we say. We're systematising that now. It's gone live in a couple of markets only the last 2 weeks ago. We are now able to track the return parcels from customers back to our fulfillment centres because that was always a big challenge. They didn't know where in the process their return was from the time it got back to us. Have we received it yet before we can process it and hand your money back? And an interesting project and trial that we've been running is in Germany. Now, Germany is the only market where we have high return rates because it's kind of a German cultural phenomenon, this buying stuff and then later returning. And we started to trial trusted exchanges where if something wasn't the right size, you send it back, we'll immediately send out your replacement size to you whilst we're waiting for your other one to come back. And that's improved our NPS over there by 5 points overnight. I mean, it's phenomenally strong. So it's important that even if we don't have many returns in general, when we deal with them, we do it really well.
I mean, that is just spot on. And I mean, for me, there are two things. One is, in a modern payment era, when as I walk through the tube, before the gate has closed behind me, my iPhone has said my card's been debited, when I can send money around the world and, you know, it's just instantaneous. This whole, would you like to wait for 6.5 years and then maybe this will hit your account, is just beyond unacceptable. It's like the old days of having carbon, you know, manual machines. So I think there has been a little bit of taking the mickey when it comes to slow returns. But I think what Ricky is also pointing out is when your operational basis is rock solid, then you can trust that the return is happening. So it's not like, I don't believe it, I've got it in my hands and I've looked at it. It's, no, you've given it to Yodel, you've given it to DPD, that's good enough for me, it's in our system, and that can instantly trigger your refund. And, you know, you'll have this often where you'll just send something back, they'll scan it, you throw it in the box to be picked up later, and it says, thank you, we now have your product, here's your money back. And that, to me, is just a thing of joy.
It's one of the areas that I think we'll see a huge, well, I'm not sure if battleground's the right phrase, but I think it will be an area where brands will look to truly differentiate. Mm. When they get a handle on, you know, customer data, they'll be able to, as Ricky mentioned, take that trust and initiate that kind of refund immediately or that exchange immediately. So something's dispatched before something's come back.
Mm.
Some of the statistics around kind of returns, as he mentioned, in apparel, you know, 60-70% in places like Germany, like it has to be data driven, like it has to be exact, like you need operationally, like getting that stuff wrong it must be extraordinary. If like
I'm wondering what you're going to say now, because if the UK customer is vengeful, I've only got a battleground. I'm just worried now how you're going to describe German consumers.
No, it's yeah, it's like this whole thing's just complex, right? But yeah. I think this notion of, you know, a return from an operational side, we call it a return. Whereas, you know, for a customer, it's a refund. Like, actually, they just want their money back. Like, I think this is the area where, if you think about an exchange versus a refund, that's retaining the money that you want to make based on your cost to serve. Yeah. Our data would suggest you can kind of claw back something in the region of 30% of the revenue with what's called an even exchange, i.e. that t-shirt is in the wrong size, I want it in this new size, and the price is the same. Of course, the volume is in uneven, i.e. that t-shirt looks terrible on me, I'm going to exchange it for this pair of socks. And so I want some money back. And the retailer is, you know, retaining, you know, that level of revenue within the business.
Mm.
That's the bit where I think it will get really interesting for the brands that get that right, being able to initiate that uneven exchange really, really quickly, or an even exchange, and push that inventory out to the customer before they've got the other piece back.
Mm.
That will be powered by, you know, technology, integration, and a knowledge of the customer to have that level of trust. It's not going to be easy, but it will be a really good way for brands to differentiate.
And I think we should also try and move past the fashion world where you buy things, you get things, you send things back. It's all about thing, 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 buy, buy, buy. Whereas increasingly, if you look at, say, consumer electronics or things where you're going to have and use the product for a long time, the moment of purchase and delivery are tiny compared to the years of using it. So if you look at something like Apple, you're buying a new MacBook Pro and you trade your old MacBook Pro in. So you don't want to be without your machine. So what happens is they do the trade-in, you tell them it's like they trust you, they give you the discount, they send you the new machine with another box to send your own machine back. So there's a continuity of enjoying your MacBook Pro, and then you get a note later saying, yes, you're absolutely right, we've credited your account as you asked.
Yeah.
So I think moving towards this living with a customer in their life rather than looking at everything as if it's just, you know, give me your money, get lost, repeat.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a new opportunity for more experience and service-based brands.
I agree. I'll give you another example. We were talking to Nick Mitchell at Russell & Bromley, who we must try and get on the podcast. You know, if you're spending, you know, £300 on a pair of shoes that get delivered to your home and you try them on and they don't fit, like, you're not going to spend another £300 whilst you're waiting for your £300 exactly. refund.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to have this robust returns mm-hmm. stroke exchanges process to make that experience with the Russell & Bromley brand, which ultimately, you know, higher end, more of a luxury product. They want to provide that type of experience, and it's like really hard to do. So
it's like putting your customer in the sin bin.
Mm-hmm.
So you say to them, you had your chance, you bought my product, you are now taken out of the economic game for a couple of weeks until I've processed this and given it back. Now, the retailer might say, well, I don't care because I've got your money and I'll wait for your next pay packet, that'll be fine. But the customer may want to cross shop with other brands in the same category, etc. So the link to buy now, pay later, which, if you like, is a force multiplier for that £300, because you can use it, test it, return it, and still be liquid, which means that there's been an enormous boom of people, you know, multiplying that 300 across multiple retailers and cycling things more quickly.
Yep.
But again, you can't blame people for wanting to do that when we're the ones who are often sin binning them or marginalising them.
But it's really interesting because 61% of consumers say they would prefer an exchange if the process was easier. As you said with Russell and Bromley, you've bought a pair of shoes. If you've spent £300 on a pair of shoes, you like those shoes. You just want them to fit. They might be slightly pinchy. And so sizing, I know we can't compare it with electronics because it's not the same, but sizing is so important. And we've actually got some input from Ricky on even just the sizing of bracelets.
We have two different type of size issues, I guess. So charms only come in one size. But bracelets come in many sizes and rings come in many sizes. And so they're the ones where we see the changes for that. And actually, it's quite difficult to help customers, even though we print them on the screen and do like that, in terms of what might be the right size to wear your bracelet. And I mean, I'm sure you must know this, Ian, but depending on how many charms you decide to put on your bracelet, it depends on what size bracelet that you need. You know, you might want more than one size bracelet in your jewelry box in terms of, you know, depending on the look you're gonna rock that day. So there's a bit there. But one of the other slight challenges we have comes to compatibility. So we have different types of bracelets and charms, and therefore some are compatible with some bracelets and others are compatible with others. And so how we help the customers understand that is one of the challenges at the front end, you know, that we do. You're totally right. The majority of those which we get are due to size more than anything else, and they tend to relate to the those categories I mentioned earlier rather than the charms themselves.
So we can't get away from sizing when we talk about returns, because it is going to be a massive driver. And even retailers like Pandora are doing everything they can at the buying button to ensure that you can pick the right size. And so there's technology in place at the front end. But we've spoken time and time again on this podcast already about data. And even with all the data in the world, consumers aren't always going to get it right and therefore need to return items.
Absolutely. And I think the difference between something physical where, you know, if the charm is 6 millimetres, I get 6 millimetres, it's then just a matter of conformance. With apparel and footwear, it's not just about size, it's about fit. So you mentioned a phrase just now that made me chuckle, which is it may pinch a bit. And it's always a joke that if the shoes look great enough, it doesn't matter about fit, because you can always chop a toe off or suffer for a while. And we were mentioning earlier about Saucony and how important fit is there. So there was a startup some years ago that used robot mannequins. It was an Estonian startup called FitMe that showed a shirt on different body sizes. And their founder, a really lovely guy, tall, fit man, we wore the same shirt size. And on me, it was a short, fat guy with a baggy shirt. On him, it was a muscular guy with a skin-tight shirt. I would never wear a shirt like that. But it was the same size, but we had different fit profiles. And he was going for that muscle look, and I was going for a more baggy look. Anyway, fit and size aren't the same. So once you get into apparel, you have these levels of subjectivity as well as functional use coming in. And so understanding the data behind that, as well as just the absolute returns, is really important.
Yeah, I remember that startup, and I've tracked them for a while, and I can't get a picture out of my head of you in a shirt or wearing a Pandora charm, but maybe that's just me. But, I think... Yeah, the technology it can only go so far. So, you know, we've got dynamic imaging on the front end, you know, certainly in beauty and cosmetics, you know, we've got AI, 3D visualization, and you can see these things, but there's always going to be, you know, an element of a return being made in some way, shape or form. The question I think to ask is like, are we doing the absolute most we can to minimize them? And I think we've got pretty well a long way to go. Pandora is a really interesting one because, you know, those charms on a bracelet, you know, once you've bought that bracelet, you're kind of locked into, you know, charms being of a particular size. So there's definitely ways that a brand like Pandora can kind of track what a customer has bought and therefore, you know, what they need to complete that collection. For other brands, as you say, that nuance between, you know, performance, fit, size, you know, ultimately they're going to have to make decisions on, you know, who pays for that return based on, you know, how loyal they've been maybe in the past or their customer profile or some form of segmentation to get that balance right.
Hitting the nail on the head with performance there. When you are spending probably a lot of money on a pair of high performance running shoes, you do want to get it right. And we can hear more from Stephen on what they are doing at Wolverine.
Obviously, as we start to kind of bring back data from the consumer to understand what the return reason was, or if there was a faulty product, or if it was a sizing issue, or if it was just that they bought two and they wanted to return one back. You know, all of those things are more telling and allow us to kind of get better as a product-led business. We historically haven't been great at kind of aggregating that data and getting it to a point where we can really use it to kind of take learnings into the business. We've recently started up a partnership with Narvar, which I've used in prior organizations, and that's been a really useful tool for us to get real-time data on return reasons and also offer digital returns to make it easier for the consumer as well, you know. So from my perspective, I see that one kind of rolling out later this year and becoming a big help for us to kind of get a better understanding there.
I mean, what's interesting there is he's sort of reminding us that generic good practice gets you so far, but specific link between your product and the customer is important. And so, you know, the fit on a running shoe is different from the fit on a yoga shoe. The fit on walking trousers is different to fit on maybe, you know, your latest denim acquisition. So I think, you know, one of the things I'm also seeing a lot more now is using profiling to help the customer understand fit. So, you know, if you're on Instagram and you've been looking at people who are, you know, working out at the gym, then the next clothes ad that you'll get will be for athletic fit, stretch clothing for your enormous muscles, et cetera, et cetera. Or you might be, you know, after more stretch or travel clothing. So I think trying to bring in the data that is generally good is useful, but also specific for your customer and your product, that's where you can really add, I think, a service level and differentiate yourself.
I think that's a really great idea. I haven't seen much of it, which really surprises me. So, you know, for a brand like Saucony, for someone that is a professional runner who buys a pair of trainers in a particular size, I see a future where, you know, the brand will know how far I'm running, you know, how long those trainers are going to last for, and will be able to help me at the right time with the right size in the future for the new trainer when my first product has kind of expired. I think those types of things, I just don't see a lot of that. There seems to be kind of, you know, you tend to just be marketed to continually as if you were a new customer all of the time.
A good
but
point.
If we capture this, if we capture returns information, if we're capturing this segmentation of customers, yeah, I see a really good future in terms of minimizing, say, a return or something like that.
Yes, but we have been today taking a very brand focused view on life. And we've mentioned retails, but I think it's worth maybe just wrapping round to the importance of specialist retailers. So whether you're a retailer that just happens to understand what 20-year-old urban girls want to wear when they're going out partying, or whether it's, you know, a later age runner who's coming back to mid-distance running after years off. So the ability to go to a retailer, whether it's someone like She Runs or an Ellis Brigham for trail running, and see great brands like Saucony next to, you know, Brooks, New Balance, Nike, etc., Merrell, and be told you might like the look of the Saucony, but given your weight, foot size, running style, etc., this is the one that's going to not give you shin splints or whatever. That expertise is important, especially, again, I keep coming back to this, if you're going to live with your customer beyond the season, they're going to change and develop, you're changing and developing. So I think this conversation is really important, brokering between them, and then you're empowered, if you like, to buy from brand once you found them. But the retailer does play a very big part in this.
And I think it's really interesting. We've got a lot of exciting things to come, both in the space of at the buy button, before the buy button. But when it happens and the returns are streamlined and made better, you are going to retain that customer. And it is, they're going to come back time and time again.
Fantastic. Well, I think we're coming to the end of returns by returning
to returns. To returns.
Really good. And in fact, if we're listening to this after you listen to the other ones, it makes more sense. But if you're starting here, then we're going back to the beginning to look at the buying process.
Look at Recircular.
Exactly.